I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to Where is Bruce Schuller? This is episode 9, A Can of Worms. My name is Graham Crowley. Thank you very much for listening. Greetings from New South Wales. We're currently doing a caravan odyssey through New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia, and exploring a new potential podcast on the way. Stay tuned. This podcast has been created for an adult audience, so listener discretion is advised. The thoughts and opinions in this podcast are mine. Thank you again to my awesome sponsors supporting my coffee habit. Your contributions are gratefully accepted. In episode 8, we heard remarkable audio from the main Crown witness contradicting himself repeatedly on significant issues. So much so, if I hadn't heard it, I would doubt it. But I did hear it, as you did. I said at the end of the episode, I was speechless. It actually took me a long time to process and understand what I had heard. And there was also evidence where the other Crown witnesses contradicted each other, repeatedly. What is the upshot of all that? Well, in my view, three prospectors are not reliable or credible witnesses, and never were, and at times appeared to be dishonest. It would take a lot to persuade me otherwise. What really happened in that gully that day in July 2012? We do not know, but unfortunately, we cannot believe anything the prospectors said unless it was independently verified. And the majority of it wasn't. You may recall earlier in the podcast, I said the case basically came down to the word of the prospectors versus the word of the Strubers. Were the Strubers even in the gully that day? Sadly, the jury only heard selective evidence. Why was that? On whose authority? I would like to know who decided not to tell the jury the truth of what happened in the gully. Who played God? Is there any evidence that independently corroborates the prospectors' claims? Can we have confidence in anything the prospectors said under oath? Let's look at that. No body, no cause of death, but a lot of speculation that he was shot. No physical evidence, no forensic evidence. No DNA on the Strubers, their clothing, their vehicles, or in their house or property. No admissions, only denials. No evidence the Strubers were even in the gully, except by the word of three very unreliable witnesses. It seems to me it comes down to the tyre tracks down the ravine and the scrape mark on the anthill. I know very little about the scrape mark, apart from what I've read. The prosecutor said this in summing up to the jury. Termite mounds that had been knocked over and had gouge marks. The gouge marks are consistent with being made by a metal component on the undercarriage of the unregistered Toyota Land Cruiser owned by the accused. To sum that up in one sentence, the marks are consistent with the underneath of the Land Cruiser, and I would suggest consistent with thousands of other four-wheel drive vehicles. I have covered the tyre tracks down the ravine before and do not propose to revisit it, other than to say that in the officer's initial statement, he concluded the tracks were consistent with the registered vehicle and not the unregistered vehicle. And in his second statement, he confirmed the tracks were not consistent with the unregistered utility. There was much to say at the Court of Appeal and even the High Court of Australia regarding the tyre tracks. But in a circumstantial case where the only two remaining points of evidence are gouge marks on anthills and tyre tracks in grass and cow pats, I say it is very shaky ground. If you dispute that, please let me know. Two people are destined to spend the rest of their lives in a Queensland prison based on that evidence. The Court of Appeal had this to say about those tyre impressions.
Cow pats with tyre impressions corresponding in class characteristics, tread design and wear to the tyres on the appellant's unregistered vehicle were also marked. These could have been made by the tyres on the appellant's unregistered vehicle or any other tyres with similar tread characteristics.
I have been very far down that slippery slope. As many listeners would know, I spent many years investigating the murder of Leanne Holland, for which Graham Stafford served life imprisonment. Some of the strongest Crown evidence in that case were two separate tyre impressions found at the body disposal dump site. A policeman with 6 years' service, a science degree, and no tyre experience decided those impressions were identical to the two different tyre sizes on Graham Stafford's car. To be accurate, he initially said the tyre impressions were similar, but by the time trial came around, the two impressions were identical to the two unusual tyre sizes on Graham Stafford's car. The trial judge was so impressed with that evidence, he mentioned it 17 times in his summing up, that the two separate tyre impressions at the scene were identical to the tyres on Graham Stafford's car. I'm not going to speculate what impact that had on the jury. When I read the trial transcript for the first time, I concluded Stafford was at the body disposal site and he was likely lying. Except the tyres were not identical. One was similar, but not identical. The other was not even close. Both tyres were manufactured by Bridgestone. I was fortunate to engage the services of two senior Bridgestone employees with a combined experience of more than 60 years between them, who concluded the tyres were not identical. Stafford's conviction was quashed 17 years after his original conviction. Not just on that point, I might add. There were many, many points. It is now 33 years since the murder of Leanne Holland. It remains unsolved. Graham Stafford continues to protest his innocence. It is not enough that his conviction was quashed. He wants the world to know he had nothing to do with the murder of Leanne. So forgive me if I doubt the evidence about Struber's tyres and scrape marks on the undercarriage without seeing strong scientific evidence to support those conclusions, particularly in dry, arid land such as Palmerville in midwinter, as shown in the police crime scene photographs. After episode 8, I thought I had pretty much dug up all the buried gold there was to find about the disappearance of Bruce Shuler. And here we are, more buried treasure. Episode 9, A Can of Worms. What is it about this case? Why is all this previously unknown evidence only coming out now and in a podcast? I am not a conspiracy theorist and never have been. But boy, this one's testing my patience. I had repeatedly heard rumours, comments and stories about Bruce Shuler making a phone call from his satellite phone on Sunday night, 8 July 2012, from somewhere other than the riverbed of the Palmer River. We knew Bruce Shuler had a satellite phone with him. The prospectors mentioned it frequently. They left a message under his windscreen to call them on his sat phone. Bruce Shuler's satellite phone was in the possession of prospector Dan Bidner until Saturday, 14 July 2012, 5 days after Bruce Shuler went missing. Diary notes indicate that whilst he was in the company of Queensland Police that day, he gave the satellite phone to a third party to give to police, which was duly done. And then QPS diaries recorded the sat phone being seized at Bruce Shuler's mining camp. I had never been able to confirm the rumours and stories about the phone call. And believe me, I was digging. There were a number of people who knew about it, but no one could show me something concrete. Until now. Buried in one of the 180 statements in the police brief was a statement by an SAR police officer, search and rescue. He had this to say at point 32 of his statement. For clarification, we know this was a satellite phone owned by Bruce Shuler.
At approximately 11 a.m. on Saturday, 14th of July, 2012, I forwarded a request to obtain satellite telephone information belonging to the missing person ending in 58681, including last known location and usage. I subsequently received a latitude and longitude of 16.0051 south and 144.1279 east as the last point on 8th of July 2012 at 9:33 GMT. Reverse call data was not available. This location is consistent with the missing person's camp located near to Palmerville Station, approximately 120 miles north-northwest of Cairns. When plotted, I determined this to be approximately 12 kilometres to the east of the missing person's last known position.
Why is that significant? For several reasons. 09:33 GMT, Greenwich Mean Time, is 7:33 p.m. Eastern Australian Time. Bruce Shuler's satellite phone pinged at 7:33 p.m. on Sunday, 8 July 2012. Remember Malaysian Airlines flight MH370? Went missing in the Southern Ocean off Western Australia. They were able to track its last known flight path by a computer in the aircraft pinging satellites, just as Bruce Shuler's phone did. I guess that's why they call them satellite phones. More importantly was the location recorded by the satellite. 16 degrees 51 south and 144 degrees 1279 east, and the date and time. In a straight line, that GPS location is about 3.5 kilometres from the camp in the bed of the Palmer River, about 5 kilometres by road. Apparently 12 kilometres by road as calculated by the SAR officer, possibly from the homestead. Did we hear about this from the prospectors? Not at all. Did we hear about it from the prosecutor at trial? Not at all. It goes without saying that information was never mentioned at trial. According to the amigos, they spent the night in the camp in the bed of the Palmer River. One of them had this to say in their statement. Then Kevin turned up and he was the last in camp that night. We then proceeded to sit around and have beers and talk gold chat and detecting chat. We had a few laughs and talked about gold found and gold lost. We didn't have a late night, cause we always get up at 5:30 a.m. when we're camping, cause we set up and take advantage of the cool morning for detecting. And like everything else the prospectors had to say, there was just so much to unpack with that one paragraph. Firstly, it depended on whose version you accepted as to who was last in the camp. No mention was made of going 5 kilometres down the road at 7:30 p.m. at night to make a phone call or prospect or whatever you do down a gully in the middle of the bush in the dark. No explanation why it took up to 2 hours to leave camp the next day. I spoke with George Wilson. To my knowledge, George knows Palmerville better than any person alive. I consider he is an expert on the property. Who better to ask?
Morning, Graham.
How you going, George?
Yeah, not too bad. Pretty good, thank you.
That's the way. Thanks again for your time.
Yes.
As far as I'm concerned, George, you are the person most likely to know anything and everything about Palmville Station, from what I can find. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I do.
Would anyone know Palmville Station better than you?
Not really, no. I know it pretty well. Yeah. I've flown over it, I've drove over it, I've rode horses all over it.
You've worked it, you've lived there.
Yeah, walked it.
And that's why I consider when I want to know something about Palmville, you're the go-to person. So, can you help?
No worries.
We've been discussing some GPS points.
Yes.
In particular, 16.0051 South and 144.1279 East.
Yes.
What can you tell me about those GPS points, George?
Well, from what I've got off Bob Hayden, he sent me some information, like where that area was. And then we went up and had a bit of a look, and that's at the 6 Mile beside the old mustering hut there. And apparently he had got where a phone call was made there from Mr. Shuler, from what I can gather. That's what Bob told me. And, he was cut off, but it happened at 7:30 at night. That was on the Sunday night.
Yeah. What can you tell me about the location?
The location is just off the side, like near a steep gully. It's pretty well in the steep gully. And, you'd wonder why somebody would be there even at that time of night. Like, why the hell would you even go in there? You know, like, you can make calls from anywhere, but why in there? It's like as if you're trying to hide from something or somebody or something, you know, trying to get away.
So it's in rough country in a steep gully.
Yes, very rough, like down in... On top, it's not so bad, but once you get over into the gully, it's very steep, yes.
And is that where the GPS point was, in the gully?
Yes, down in the gully, yes. Like as if you're trying to hide down in the gully because you've been hunted or chased by something, yes, yeah, or someone. Yeah, yeah.
And where is that GPS point, say, in relation to the Palmer River bed where the Shuler and the prospectors were camping?
Oh, it's east of there, 5K or better by road from where they were camping in the river.
Over good road or rough road?
Reasonable road there because it's on the Maytown Road. So you're travelling up, and at that time of year it was a pretty good road because the council had graded it. They were working on it at the actual time.
Yeah.
Yes, so it's not a really rough road. And then when you drive off to go down into there from the Maytown Road, it's not so bad. It's just like to walk that bit over into there is a little bit rugged because it's got a lot of, there's some exposed limestone rocks and stuff and then like high grass and things like that. But yes.
It's near a dam called the 6 Mile, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah. It's the bordering dam for the cattle in the 6 Mile paddock. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Is there any prospecting around there?
No, not right there. You could go further upstream, like a kilometre or two, and then you will find a bit area there to prospect. I've done a bit there myself. And then you can find gold, or you go north across the river, and there's an area there called the Fish Creek Diggings, or the Fish Creek Terrace, they call it, which we know it as the 6 Mile Alluvial Diggings. The Chinese worked an area there, but that's across there. It'd be about 2K from the actual spot, yeah.
How far from the riverbed, like in a straight line, would the closest part of the Palmer River be to that GPS point?
I'd say about 100 metres. The riverbed would be 100 metres from GPS point, yes.
So the chance of Bruce Shuler prospecting at 7:30 p.m. at night in a gully 5 kilometres from where they're camped would be next to zero.
That's right.
Yep.
Yeah, right. And that area there, very hard to sort of get around at night, you know, even if you've got a light, because it's just quite rugged. As I said, there's even some limestone rocks, like, sticking out of the ground, because the limestone in areas just pokes up out of the ground, and you're probably looking at about, say, 2 foot high, very sharp, and you're sort of moving around. And that's another sign where you wouldn't even be prospecting there, because there's no gold in that type of area. There, why those are diggings across the river, and I must say there, to get to those on the other side of the river is very steep. You've got to go up a real steep hill. It'd have to be one part there, unless you get on the old track where someone tried to come down with a bulldozer. You nearly got to go straight up for like 50 or better feet straight up. It's a steep bank. And there's a big water hole in the river there, just below where you go down, water hole in the bend of the river that's quite deep.
Yep.
Yes, yeah. That water hole would have to be, like, I think they said it's something like 7 metres deep. We had some people come through one time and they were checking the depths of the water holes.
Yep.
And they were using it like a depth sounder, and that was like at the end of the year as well.
Mm.
So it's quite a deep water hole there, right on the bend, yeah.
Be some good barramundi there, I'd say.
There is, yeah. Yep. No, that's one of the good holes for catching barramundi there.
Yep.
Yep. Yep.
The police officer said this comment, referring to the GPS points that I read out.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Yep.
Yes.
This location is consistent with the missing persons camp located near Palmerville Station. I don't agree with that, but I'd like your thoughts on it.
Yeah, I don't agree with it either. It's got nothing to do. It's far, far away.
It's nowhere near the missing persons camp, was it?
That's right. Definitely nowhere near. Exactly.
And yep. The police officer also said this. When plotted, I determined this to be approximately 12 kilometres to the east of the missing persons last known point. Can you explain how you say it's 5 kilometres by road, but the police officer said it's approximately 12 kilometres?
Yes, the road doesn't, if you talk in a straight line, around by road, and that would be from Palmerville, not actually from that site, there it would be about that, because you've got to go either out around the, like on the Laura Road and come back. That would put you on the 12 kilometres. But if you went up through via where that site is and then out and around, it would be, like as I said, it would be a little further there. But if you went straight up the river from where they were camped, which was up a bit, then it's about 5 kilometres. But if you go out around the road, you've got about another 3, and then you've got to come back about 1.5. So you've got to add that on to...
Okay.
That's from where Shula went missing, yeah.
So if the police officer is referring to Palmerville Station, then it would be approximately 12 kilometres to the east.
That's correct, yes.
Okay, that clarifies that.
Yes.
George, that's all I have for you.
Okay, no worries. That's all right, Graham.
As usual, I appreciate your assistance in this matter. Thank you.
No worries. Thank you too, yes.
All right, well, you have a great day.
All right, thanks, Graham. Bye.
What was Bruce Shuler doing 5 kilometres by road from the riverbed campsite at 7:33 p.m. on the Sunday night? I have added photos to the Facebook page, Graham Crowley Podcast Investigations, to show the location where the satellite phone pinged in comparison to the prospector's camp in the Palmer riverbed. The reality is that phone call was the independently corroborated last confirmed contact with Bruce Shuler, apart from the claims by the prospectors. I have studied the police file. I cannot find where that GPS location was searched by police after that data became known. It doesn't mean it wasn't, just that I cannot find a record of where it was. The police records indicate the search for Bruce Shuler was suspended that same day, Saturday, 14 July 2012 at 3 p.m. On that basis, I think we can conclude that GPS location was never searched. It appears a helicopter did fly over the area, but I don't know if that was before or after that date. But what about the SAR officer? That was his job, search and rescue. Did he organise for that GPS location to be thoroughly searched on foot? Immediately. And if not, why not? Last known contact. Last known location. They should have been all over it. Unfortunately, it appears it was ignored. And if that area was never searched by foot, shouldn't it now be searched as a matter of urgency, even though it has been 12 years since his disappearance? Some evidence may still be found. And who determined this comment? This location is consistent with the missing person's camp located near to Palmville Station. Sorry, it certainly is not consistent with his camp. Searching that location by Queensland Police Service may cause a conundrum. If possessions of Bruce Shuler are located there, or his remains, what would that mean for the investigation? It would be great if his remains were discovered and returned to the family. But what would the odds be of Struburn Wilson disposing of those remains in the exact same position he had been in the previous night? In the circumstances, I believe the Queensland Police Service is now obligated to search that location. But nothing would surprise me any more with this case. So many questions. More questions than answers. Have we now reached the end of the discrepancies in the evidence? Who knows? I will keep analysing the material to see what further gems exist, if any. In the interim, I have emailed Detective Sergeant Brad McLeish and Prosecutor Nigel Rees an invitation to be interviewed for the podcast and answer questions in relation to this and numerous other matters. I have also emailed the defence solicitors and barristers who appeared at trial to be interviewed for the podcast to discuss why literally a mountain of matters were not raised at trial in cross-examination. Whilst I have placed the email on the Facebook page, I considered it relevant to read out salient parts here with explanations as required. Hello, Brad. I hope this finds you well. I am extending an invitation to you and also to Prosecutor Nigel Rees to participate in a recorded audio interview for a forthcoming episode of my podcast, Where is Bruce Shuler? I would appreciate if you could forward my email to Prosecutor Rees to enable him to reply to me directly. I would like to discuss the following matters. 1. In the diaries of two police officers, it was noted Crown Witness Tremaine Anderson claimed he went to the Palmerville homestead on the afternoon of Monday, July 9, 2012, whilst looking for Bruce Shuler. That was never recorded in any statement and was not mentioned at trial. Did he walk there? Did he drive there? What time did he go there? What time did he arrive back at camp? They were supposedly in fear of Stephen Struber. Why was that information not made known to the jury? Were there any concerns as to the reliability, credibility, and truthfulness of the witness after this change of version of events? 2. Crown Witness Dan Bidner gave three very different versions of the one incident to police over three consecutive days when referring to his actions when the Struber Ute drove past him returning to the homestead. His audio is in episode 8 of my podcast, recorded by Queensland Police Service and therefore known to both QPS and DPP. How did the investigators conclude the witness was reliable, truthful, and credible after hearing those differing versions? And in case you have forgotten, I will replay the classic comment by Witness Bidner from the Monday night.
When it started up the move the second time, it drove, turned around and drove back down the spur along the river back towards the homestead. The only thing I regret, Sarge, is I didn't lift my head up to, because I was scared, you know, worried.
But that's understandable.
I didn't lift my head high to visually get a visual. I lifted my head a little bit, but I didn't stand up, and I just saw, like, the top bars of the car, you know, like the,
okay,
the roof and the top,
yep,
bars.
Yep.
In the reenactment, as you heard, Bidner then stood to his haunches, But as I pointed out, he was actually likely standing on tiptoe. In point three in the email, I wrote this. At trial, under cross-examination, when being questioned regarding that very matter, the only conclusion that could be reached was the witness was obfuscating when answering the questions. Were you, as investigators and prosecutor, concerned at the way he answered questions regarding that matter? Did you consider at that time whether he was a reliable, credible, and truthful witness? And just to add to that for the listener, in the evidence in chief at trial, Bidner said this, "And that's when I slightly lifted myself up from my position and I witnessed the top of that vehicle heading back to the homestead." Question 4. Who made the decision not to inform the jury of his three significantly different versions of that event? 5. Crown Witness Bidner gave three very different versions of the one incident to police over three consecutive days when referring to the sort of weapon Diane Wilson was alleged to be carrying after exiting the vehicle. His audio is in episode 8 of the podcast, recorded by QPS and therefore known to both QPS and DPP. Who made the decision for Bidner to go with the black stick version at trial? How did investigators conclude the witness was reliable, truthful, and credible after hearing those conflicting versions? 6. Who made the decision not to inform the jury of his three significantly different versions of that event? 7. Crown witnesses Bidner and Anderson repeatedly told police the Struby Ute did a U-turn after the second gunshot and travelled in the direction of the homestead. Witness Groth corroborated those claims. Those claims were never raised at trial. Who made the decision not to inform the jury of that significant information? 8. At no time were the versions of the Crown witnesses ever disputed. Therefore, on what basis could it be reasonably inferred the Struby Ute drove down the ravine to the second crime scene when the Crown witnesses specifically and clearly stated the Ute turned around and travelled in the direction of the homestead and never went down the ravine? The witnesses remained in the area for the remainder of the day and the Ute was not heard to return to the crime scenes. 9. Who made the decision not to mark the spot on diagrams and maps produced by police of the spot where the Struby Ute performed a U-turn and returned in the direction of the homestead? Apart from being seen by the Crown witnesses, it was noted in audio recordings that several police pointed out the U-turn location also. 10. Crown witness Bidner gave two very different versions of the one incident to police over three consecutive days when referring to returning to the camp after the second gunshot. Who decided to accept the "he prospected his way back to the campsite" as opposed to "he didn't prospect his way back to the campsite"? Who made the decision not to inform the jury of these conflicting versions of his movements on the day? 11. When he gave that evidence, were you concerned that he had also given a contradictory statement as to what he did on the way back to the camp? 12. I take it the QPS and DPP were not concerned with the credibility and truthfulness of the witness after those conflicting versions became known. On what basis did the QPS and DPP decide the witnesses were credible, honest, and truthful? 13. There were significant discrepancies given by Crown witnesses Anderson and Groth of their meeting around 3 p.m. on Monday 9 July 2012 near the campsite. Whose version was ultimately accepted as accurate? Were the QPS and DPP concerned with the reliability, credibility, and truthfulness of the witness after hearing of their different versions of that meeting. 14. Bruce Schuller had a satellite phone in his possession. And just to cut it out there, I repeat what you heard earlier in the episode regarding the GPS locations, etc. 15. I point out to the police and DPP about the distance from the camp, etc. I finish off the point by saying, was a foot search of those GPS coordinates conducted after they became known? Were the prospectors questioned as to why Bruce Schuller would be there at 7:33 p.m. on the Sunday night when they claimed they were in camp on the riverbed? 16. It was accepted witness Anderson told Walter Randall he heard 3 shots that day. Were you concerned Anderson was an honest, reliable and credible witness? 17. The Crown witnesses repeatedly told QPS they were waiting for a phone call from Bruce Schuller on his satellite phone. Yet this phone was in possession of witness Daniel Bidner from 9 July to 14 July 2012. This phone was apparently handed to Detective Sergeant McLeish by a third party named CS. Yet Detective Sergeant McLeish did not take a statement from CS. He also recorded in his statement that he seized the satellite phone from the camp of Bruce Schuller. Which version was the truth? 18. The above matters are not the only matters of concern as to the truthfulness, credibility, and honesty of the Crown witnesses. I am not inclined to provide other examples of discrepancies in their evidence, although many exist. If the above matters are not enough to cause sufficient concern, it would be unlikely to sway you with any further amount of discrepancies. I consider the above shows a disturbing course of conduct by the Crown witnesses. In view of the conflicting accounts of the Crown witnesses, do you still maintain they were credible, reliable, and truthful witnesses? 19. In light of all the evidence now being aired, can you now advise what evidence exactly points to Stephen Struber and Diane Wilson being the killers of Bruce Schuller? 20. Would you support this case being referred to the Court of Appeal for consideration as a miscarriage of justice? 21. If no, how do you explain the concerning and disturbing variations in the evidence of the Crown witnesses? I look forward to hearing from you and Prosecutor Rees. I shall let you know the responses I receive, if any. I will broadcast any interviews I obtain between any of the relevant parties. I have been attempting to speak with Kevin Rusty Groth, Bruce's best friend. I did speak with him before Christmas and we had a general chat. He repeated what he said at trial. He did say he has not spoken with Bidner and Anderson since shortly after the trial. I was surprised he is no longer in contact with them. Perhaps they were never amigos. I told him I would be in touch again to discuss specific issues. Recently, I sent him this SMS. Hi Kevin, it's Graham Crowley. I tried calling you last week. Can you call me to discuss a suitable time to interview you? I have a number of questions that need clarification. I am making excellent progress, and with your assistance, I hope to be able to determine what happened to your best mate Bruce. I am yet to hear from Kevin. Please give me a call. You do want to find Bruce, right? And just a spoiler alert from my listeners, if you think you know what happened to Bruce Schuller because Stephen Struber and Diane Wilson were convicted of his murder, you have not been paying attention. That's it for A Can of Worms. Thanks for listening. I hope you have enjoyed the episode. For information, feedback or comment, you can go to the Facebook page Justice for Bruce Schuller or my page Graham Crowley Podcast Investigations. Alternatively, you can contact me at my email, graham5353@live.com. If you follow the podcast, you will be advised when a further episode is released. Please rate and review the podcast. It does help spread the story and make it visible to others who follow true crime podcasts or may have an interest in the case. please tell your family and friends. This podcast was made possible with the grateful assistance of the Acast Creator Network. Music by Janet G, whose music can be found on YouTube. If you like the podcast, you can support me for the one-off cost of a cup of coffee by transferring funds to CommBank, BSB 064180, account 1006-4508. You'll find all my contact details in the show notes at the end of each episode. Thanks again for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.